The Irving Group. TheIrvingGroup.com. San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB, presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening. Here are not Richard and Joe. It's just Richard. Well, actually, it's Richard and Richard. Joe is in, I think, Chicago. He's visiting his mom. Now, our signal doesn't carry all the way to Chicago, but I guess Joe's probably listening on his computer. But I've got Rich Gaines, one of our sponsors, in the studio with me. So it's Rich and Rich. No Joe. And we've got one of our friends on the line. We're going to take in about 1 minute. But I wanted to talk about some of our previous guests and some of the election outcomes that our previous guests predicted. Then we're going to take a quick call from one of our friends. I heard that Jerry Gross is on the line. But first of all, way back in March, Katie Klingsmith from UBS predicted that President Obama would be reelected. And she was right. And then in June, I predicted that Bob Filner would be elected mayor of San Diego. And I was right. And then Thomas McLaughlin, the head municipal bond research analyst for UBS, predicted a couple of weeks ago that Proposition 30 would pass in California, and he was right. And my partner Joe Vecchio predicted that Scott Peters would be the next congressman over Brian Bilbrey, and I'm not sure if that recount is finished yet or not, but I believe, well, Peters, I think, was about 1,300 votes ahead when I last looked, so he might be right. So we've had a lot of predictions that were correct, and so good for us. But anyway, I have to always do the caveat, just because we predict it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to come true. But a lot of predictions that we've had on this show that have turned out to be true. Hey, Jerry Gross is on the line, right? Could you put him through?
Hello, Richard.
Hey, Jerry, how are you?
Well, Richard, thank you for inviting me on the show briefly tonight. I appreciate the chance to say hello, and it's a bad day for the Chargers.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's wrong with the Chargers?
Well, I think Philip Rivers is going to have to answer that, plus the fact their number one pick a few years ago is not the greatest running back in the world. And I think that they ran into bad judgment today by the quarterback again. He's now had 12 picks, I think, and 15 touchdowns. They had more chances to win today. They had a big advantage, 13 more minutes with the ball. Still couldn't win the game, and it's a big blow, and Vincent Jackson's happy, and we found a new star today, Alexander, but Gates and Floyd couldn't do too much to overcome Tampa Bay. They won it. They deserved to win it. And it was a sad evening for a good guy, Rivers, who tries too hard, and that may be one of the problems he has. He's trying too hard to be a competitor. When it's time to throw the ball away, he wants to force it in, and it's hurt him.
Yeah, well, I wasn't surprised. I didn't watch the game. I just saw the result, but it didn't shock me. But then I saw interception return for a touchdown, a block punt return for a touchdown, and I'm thinking, yep, that's our Chargers.
Yeah, and Denver won, of course.
Of course.
And, of course, it looks like you're not going to be able to win the title, at least, and maybe not get into the playoffs. And, you know, I've been thinking one of the great moves of all time could be if Alex and Dean Spanos finally said, hey, look, let's forget it. We'll finance the new stadium. Stay with us. Hang with us. We're trying to win here. That would be one of the great PR moves of all time. I hope they'll do it, but they're two good businessmen who probably won't do it unless they need to do it.
Yeah, I agree. So let's change topics. I gave all of the election predictions that came true, but most of that was good news for the Democrats. I just asked you what was wrong with the Chargers. What's wrong with the Republican Party?
Well, they don't know how to talk about conservatism. I don't look at this. As you know, I was a talk show host, as a political talk show host, as well as a sports guy, and they don't know how to talk about conservatism. They had some good points. They hung on to the House of Representatives in Montana and Alabama and Wyoming. They are limiting Obamacare despite what Obama wants to do. Ted Cruz is back, a rising star, big victory in Texas. Pete Stark is out, bad guy in California. That's good news. The Charter School Initiative in Washington State won. That's good news. Big labor got clobbered. The unions in Michigan. Believe it or not, the union was defeated there in a radical collective bargaining power grab. And back in Montana, again, they said no to benefits for illegal aliens. No, they just said no way.
Well, so it wasn't all bad news for the Republicans last Tuesday,
no,
right?
Not at all. And one of the things that's amazing, Prop 30, as you know, you talked about it, went up the taxes. But this could be a good bit of news for the Republicans. This could conceivably destroy the Democrats financially in California.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it. I've got somebody on tonight, Rich Gaines, who's an estate planning attorney who also is very good with income tax. We're going to talk about the effects of Prop 30 on California. So it's going to be an interesting show. Yeah, because all my Republican friends are really, really depressed. But I told them, you just got to hang in there.
They shouldn't be, Richard. Holder may be quitting. Clinton's going to quit. Geithner may quit. Some of the clowns, as the Republicans feel, in the administration are leaving, although they still have Van Jones hanging around, the admitted communist who's was one of the 34 czars. But I got to tell you this. I really think that, the Benghazi thing Thursday is going to be the unraveling and maybe the Waterloo for Obama, at least as a commander-in-chief, and exposing him as not a great leader in foreign policy. This Thursday thing, if he knew about it, which allegedly they say he did, and he lied to the UN six times saying he thought that it was something to do with the DVD. If he is implicated in this, this could destroy him.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Okay, one last question. One last question. One more topic. People listening, Jerry Gross was the first Padres announcer ever in the history of the Padres, starting in 1969. So, Jerry, I was getting all excited about next season for the Padres because they did something like 57-46 over their last 103 games, and they called up this really young catcher, Grandal, who was really good, and now he's been busted for steroids, and he's out 50 games. What are your thoughts on that?
That is tragic. The kid is a good player. It's tragic. One thing I like about the Padres for next year, their pitching staff, the young staff, if they stay well, as you know, because you're a great sport fan, Richard, I think, candidly, they're going to have a better year next year than people think they will have, and I think the pitching will be the key to it. Chase Hadley completely surprised me. I never thought he was that good a player, but he sure fooled me, and he's been a big surprise, but they've got to do something now about the catching situation.
Yeah, I know. It was too bad. Hey, Jerry, I really appreciate you calling in. I've got to get to my guests, but I really appreciate you calling in, talking about football, baseball, the Republican Party.
Well, now listen, Richard, thanks for inviting me. Hang in there if you're a Republican, you folks out there. Better days are coming maybe in 2014 when the Democrats may explode if the economy continues to bottom out.
And, Jerry, thanks for you and Gretchen coming up to the beach house for the radio show party about 2 weeks ago. That was a lot of fun on the sand at my beach house in Oceanside.
Hey,
I hope Gretchen enjoyed it, too.
You're a great host, and your lovely wife and the kids were great. Thank you for including us, and thanks again for having me on the show.
All right, Jerry, have a good night.
Thank you.
All right, take care. So Rich Gaines, estate planning attorney, one of the sponsors of our show. How was that for an intro?
That was a great intro. You know, I'm always excited to come on the show, and what could be better than having two guys named Rich and Rich talking about tech stuff?
So, yeah, Rich and Rich. Yeah. Although I think we're going to be poor and poor.
Pretty soon. Things keep going the way they're going.
But Prop 30, tax policy, not just California.
Not just California. And you know, that's a good segue into tax policy and what is tax policy? What's the purpose of it? What does it want to accomplish? And we kind of have to go back in history a little bit. You know, the tax policy's purpose, you have to stimulate the economy or to manage the economy. And so if we actually go back to 1980 when Reagan came into office, his tax policy was to stimulate the economy, and he put into place tax deductions and accelerated depreciation and things that would actually get us out of a recession. Now, those policies, as they ultimately run through the economy, it takes a little bit of time to work their way through and to be effective. But I think what we saw is in the 1990s that there was massive amounts of growth in the economy. So really, Clinton was responsible for raising taxes, but that was okay because there was so much money filtering through. People were working. We had all the dot-coms. Then, of course, in 2000, that went bust. And so the first thing that Bush did was he went back to lowering tax rates and he changed all of these tax laws. So there's been a lot of movement in the tax policy. Where do we stand today? I want to read this. This is from the Green Book, which is the proposal that President Obama put forth back in February of 2012. It's very simple. It says, limiting the tax benefit of upper income taxpayers' itemized deductions would reduce the deficit, make the income tax more progressive, and that's the key, make the income tax more progressive. Progressive means that it reduces the disparity in income because you're taxing the higher income earners. And so they're saying that when you're a low income, you're not paying as much taxes. When you're high income, you're paying more taxes. Then that disparity supposedly goes away. And the most important thing that I thought was very revealing in all of this, distribute the cost of government more fairly among the various income levels. So, you know, we're really looking, in my opinion, at a situation where it's real disturbing because we're reducing the incentives for people to be successful, reducing the incentives for people to grow their businesses. And if government doesn't get itself under control, I think we're in dire straits in this country.
So are you talking about investor behavior and the behavior of, shall we say, wealthy families and the behavior of people who own closely held businesses?
Absolutely. You know, that is the quintessential piece of what tax policy does. It affects behavior. That's what taxes do. Whenever you implement a tax law, you're going to affect behavior in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, let's take a look at, the high income earners, because they're high income, they're always going to be able to deal in one way or another with whatever the tax rates are, with whatever the situation is, because they have that capacity to do so. The low-income people, they don't have that capacity. They're not paying taxes. And so where does the burden fall? The burden always ends up falling on the middle class. I'd like to give an example, which I think really would illustrate this. If you were a closely held company and you're making several million dollars and you realize that you're going to be taxed, let's say, another $50,000 because of these tax changes, well, you have a couple of choices. You can work harder and you can say, gee, why am I paying more in taxes to work harder? Or you may decide that I'm going to fire one or two people to equal that $50,000 in taxes. And so what kind of a ramification, what kind of a behavioral change would that mean for the country when you start taxing people at higher rates and you start reducing the incentives for them to work harder?
Yeah, what we might see in 2013, we had Mike Ryan from UBS talk about the fiscal cliff and sequestration. The top marginal rate right now federally is 35%, but it could go to 39.6, and then in 2013, we have what's called the Obamacare add-on tax of 3.8% on investment earnings. So that's not on wages, for example, but it's on things like interest and dividends and capital gains. And then high-income earners here in California just saw their top marginal rate increase. This would be from Prop 30 from about 10% up to potentially 13.3%. And that's retroactive to this. I mean, that's for 2012. That's not next year. Well, it is next year, but it's also this year.
Yep, yeah.
And so let's see. Let's do some quick math in my head. 39.6 and 3.8, that's 43.4 plus 13.3 is 56.7, right?
Plus 13.3. Yeah, I thought it was 11.3.
No, it could go as high as 13.3.
13.3, okay.
On incomes over $1 million.
Yeah.
Which I think it's 11.3 between like 250 and 400.
So 57 cents out of every dollar is just going to taxes, not to mention your property taxes, your sales taxes. Oh, and by the way, I don't know if people really understood this in the law, but it was a combination. It was an and. It was not only that they were taxing the high-income earners, but they were raising the sales tax 0.25%.
Right, sales tax is up to, from 7.25 to 7.5.
7.75.
Or is it 7.5 to 7.75?
7.75
to
8%. Yeah.
It's up 25 basis points.
So it's up 25 basis points. So of course, that's a what we call a regressive tax on the entire population.
Yeah.
So every time you go for a purchase, another 0.25 cent sales tax. We have some challenges, I think, in our system here. And, you know, it's anybody's guess what ultimately is going to happen. You talk about the sequestration, the fiscal cliff. Hard to say. You know, they may extend the tax laws. They may come up with some kind of a compromise. Really, really tough to know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think we'll know by the end of this year because there's not enough time.
Lame duck
kind of approach. I mean, I think there's a pretty good chance that we'll get 1 year of relief just so Congress can buy some time to deal with it, so that 2013 looks very much like 2012 in terms of income tax and estate tax. But we can talk about that some more after the break. This is It's Your Money and Your Life, and I guess your income taxes and your estate taxes too. We are going to be right back after our break. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're going to change the name of the show. Up until a minute ago, it was called It's Your Money and Your Life. Now we've decided it's their money, as in the government. It's their money and your life. So that's the new name of our show. It's their money and your life. So, Rich, speaking of it being their money, we were talking about tax policy and its effect on the behavior of business owners and wealthy families and high wage earners. And some of the projections in what you called President Obama's Green Book, what I call President Obama's tax policy budget proposal, has to do with deductions and credits and the math behind that. And, of course, that was a big debate leading up to the election. both candidate Romney as well as President Obama were criticized for being somewhat vague on the effect that their tax policy would have on revenues, both on a gross basis and a net basis. But we were talking about some numbers before the break. Would you mind sharing some of those?
Yeah, from the numbers standpoint, what we were talking about is that revenue, if there was an extension of the Bush tax cuts.
In other words, if the 2012 rules get extended through, say, 2013?
Correct.
Okay.
That revenues would actually be lower, and the outlays for refundable credits, which are things like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credits, the credits that the government gives you for simply having your kids or if you don't make enough money, those would be higher by a total of about $3.7 trillion over a 10-year period. So, you know, again, we're talking about this redistribution of wealth to the people that that need it, and it comes right out of the cost of government. You know, when we talk about deductions and credits, there are major distinctions, as you know, between those two. A deduction against your income only benefits you to the extent of the percentage that you pay in taxes. So if you're in the 20% tax bracket and you have a $10,000 deduction, it is only going to give you a $2,000 tax savings, whereas a credit is a dollar for dollar, 100% benefits. So to get the same 20% in tax credits, you're going to need an additional roughly $10,000 or $20,000 of additional deductions just to meet that same type of credit. So tax credits are very favorable, but again, it reduces the amount of revenue that the government has. And when we move into capital gains, to me, that's a huge, huge area, because if the Bush tax cuts go into place, if the Bush tax cuts become effective in 2013, the capital gains rate is going to go from 15% to 20%. So you start thinking, and dividends are going to be taxed at 3.8%. That's because of Obamacare.
And dividends could be as high as 39.6.
Dividends, that's right. The benefit on dividends would go away. It's 39.6. The
investment right now it's income, 15.
Right now it's 15.
So it could go to 43.4.
So you start thinking about behavior. What are people going to do? You know, they're not. So now you're talking about people that are saying, "Well, I had dividend paying stocks. You know, would I continue to hold dividend paying stocks?" Probably not. So they're going to sell these dividend-paying stocks. When are they going to sell them? They'd want to sell them this year because they're going to get the benefit of the 15% tax rate rather than next year. And now you're talking about a buy-and-hold philosophy where people are just hanging on to stocks. There's no money being filtered through the system. They're just holding on to things. They're not selling. They're not utilizing the capital. These are the consequences that happen.
And they're not buying more of those kinds of stocks.
And they're not buying more. They're holding on to the money. So these are the kind of disastrous consequences that we can have because of the tax policy. When we talk about behavior, and this is not a slight against President Obama. He's an excellent individual. Let's not make a mistake about that. But the question is, what are these policies? So we look at Obamacare. What's happening already, and this comes from Wall Street Journal articles, is that employers are now saying, if I have more than 50 employees, I'm going to cut my workforce down to 30 hours, less than 50 or more than 50 employees, and only pay them part-time so that I don't have to fund their health care. And we're talking about a potential penalty of $2,000 per employee. So if you've got 50 employees, 51 employees, that's $100,000 out of your pocket. To me, that's a major, major change in the way behavior occurs. And we know that the Supreme Court ruled that the states can opt out of the Medicare portion of Obamacare. That's already happening. They're already doing that. So there seems to be an unraveling and a dismantling of Obamacare just in terms of behavior.
So you're saying that not only can income tax policy affect behavior, regulation that may or may not affect income tax can affect behavior as well.
We have a great saying. It was my law partner that told me this, so I want to give him the credit for it. He said, if it moves, you tax it. If it keeps moving, you regulate it. And when it stops moving, you got to subsidize it. And so we're seeing through the system that all these regulations like Sarbanes-Oxley, Dodd-Frank, everything that's happening out there in the community, the more and more regulations that we have to comply with, we're doing more administrative work, and it prevents the entrepreneurs and the business owners from doing what they do best. I have a quick story that happened where we had a client, and the client and I went into a bank simply to change the name on the bank account because he took over as trustee for his parents who were no longer able to manage their financial affairs. And we sat down with the banker, and by the time we got done going through all of the paperwork that had to be done, the banker calling their legal department, faxing over the papers, we were an hour and a half in one bank simply to change the name on the bank account. It was totally outrageous.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a story. I got an email from a client and friend last week who's refinancing his home, and he only wants 60% loan to value. And of course, there were a lot of abuses with regard to home mortgages a few years ago, which led in part to the meltdown in the economy. But my client's fairly high net worth. I mean, he's worth a few million bucks, and he only wanted 60% loan to value on a house that's in a really nice neighborhood where you can see the ocean. And he just sent me an email saying the bank needs all of my K-1s, you know, which are the reportings from the partnerships that he and his wife are invested in. And he's got about, I don't know, 10 K-1s because he's a pretty successful guy. And he said, this is ridiculous. He says, I've created a file of about 1,000 pages just for this home loan. You know, this isn't some guy who just has 40,000 bucks on his W-2. I said, get out a ruler and just measure the size. I just want to know how tall your file is that you gave to the bank. He goes, it's 7.5 inches high.
Oh, my God.
You know, I'm like, how could anybody possibly make any money doing this?
What?
It's ridiculous. I mean, just the pure cost of, and again, this is a 60% loan to, and the house is appraised at like 30% less than it was, you know, at the peak of the market, and he only wants 60% loan to value.
What's really exciting is that the legal paperwork has become less than the real estate agents now for buying a home and the mortgage industry. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah, I guess.
They can't claim that the lawyers are doing too much papering now.
Can you imagine 7.5 inches of paper?
You know, 7.5 inches. And I want to add on to that story that it's not only the K-1s from the partnerships that he's getting, but I've had clients now actually asking that the banks are asking for the partnership returns themselves.
Wow.
To show that the partnership returns are legitimate. And, you know, I think that's somewhat of an invasion of privacy there. So it's a real question.
I would agree because there's confidential information
there. There is. But if you want the loan, what do you do?
Yeah, what do you do?
You got to get the loan. You know, when we talk about the mortgage debacle and what happened, you know, we had very, very bright people in the country. Greenspan as the...
Rich, we're getting some music.
Oh, we are.
We're
going
to hold that thought.
Got to hold that thought.
So it's their money and your life. And when we come back, we'll try to make it your money and your life, okay? Stay with us. Welcome back on our journey from it being their money and your life to being it's your money and your life. I'm here with Rich Gaines, estate planning expert at Family Legacy Legal. FamilyLegacyLegal.com, right, Rich?
Yes.
And your phone number, 760-931-9923.
Excellent memory.
That's my memory. 760-931-9923 if you want the best estate planning attorney in Southern California. That would be my guess, Mr. Rich Gaines. Let me thank our other sponsors as well. UBS, Michael Quarantra, Drew Freitas, thank you very much. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, soon to be a father for the first time. Your life will never be the same. Joel Greshkin and Cost Segregation Initiatives. Joel's coming up soon. If you happen to own commercial real estate, cost segregation is a huge, huge opportunity right now to improve your working capital and cash flow. Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton at Regions Bank, finest business bank in San Diego. Our favorite CPAs, Don Epic CPA and Paul Polito CPA with, you can guess the name, Polito Epic CPAs. Carl Sheeler and Business Valuations Limited. Hey, Carl, I'm confirming breakfast at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning at the University Club. So if you're listening, shoot me an email that we're good to go. I think we've already confirmed. And lastly, but not least, of course, our guest, Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal. So, Rich, never a dull moment. We were talking about a 7.5 file to get a loan.
Where do you go from there?
Where do you go from there? So where do you want to go from there?
Well, I want to talk about a little bit more about the regulation and the costs and what's going on in the state of California. What's happened is the North County Probate Court closed. So there are no more cases being heard up there.
Yeah, and the probate court, for listeners who don't know, that is the court that administers, the estates of people who pass away, wills and trust. Well, not trust. If you have a living trust, you can avoid the probate court. But if you have a trust dispute, you go through the probate court.
That's exactly right. And so what's happened is we have 1 million, that's 1 million people who are being displaced down to the downtown San Diego courthouse.
And how many people work in the downtown office of the probate department?
Well, we're talking judges down there, and there is a whopping, you're going to love this, a whopping 2 judges. And that is it. So they are handling that.
So that's all. So 2 judges for all of San Diego County.
For all of San Diego County.
Okay.
So we talk about the concept of FAIL. FAIL is what it's an acronym we coined for family anger in lawsuits. And that's what happens when the planning is not done correctly, when people have plans that they really don't communicate those plans. They don't bring the families together. They don't unite around the common purpose. We were chatting at the break about a family business and a family that you were talking with, and you had asked them, well, why are they doing what they do? What's their purpose? And the client looked at you, and he was flabbergasted. He didn't have an answer, and you were kind of perplexed because it seemed like an easy question.
I thought it was an easy question.
And his response was?
At least it was a short question. He said, that's the first time any professional service advisor has ever asked me that question. My specific question was, what are the two or three key values of your family? And with regard to your family business, why are you guys doing what you're doing? What's your purpose?
And that's what we do in our organization at Legacy Legal. We look at the values of the family. We look at the purpose of the family. We like to do what we call plan. Preserve legacy, act nurturing. And to us, that's really, it's a lifestyle choice. It's act nurturing. Each and every day, what do you do to make sure that your family has the right attitudes, it has the right education, it has the right values, the things to carry on either the family business or the wealth or whatever it is that they want to give back to the community.
Yeah, I call that family governance. And my criticism of most wealth advisors, whether that's stockbrokers or people who manage assets, estate planning attorneys, CPAs, everybody's focused on getting the family's business or the money ready for the family, and the focus really should be on getting the family ready for the money or the business. It's a big difference.
It is a big difference. So we call that either family wealth focused or family centered focus, where we focus on the family itself. And so really that leads us into what's happening with the estate and gift tax laws.
Yeah, I told all my families, I said, you've got a partner. It's called the Internal Revenue Service. Partner in your business, partner in your family. They're a family member because they own somewhere between 35 or 45 or maybe even 55% of what you have, even though you don't necessarily realize it.
They do, and we've talked before on the show about there's just a tremendous opportunity right now for people to be able to transfer $5.12 million per person, over $10.2 million this year without paying any tax whatsoever. Next year, without any changes to the tax law, and the rate at which the president and the Congress are going, if we don't have any changes and those Bush tax cuts expire, we're talking $1 million per person, $2 million total. That's the most that you can protect. So to take advantage of almost an $8 million transfer of wealth is absolutely huge in today's times.
Plus, the tax rate presently, 35%, would go up to 55%.
It would go up
if we sunset back to the $1 million amount.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So now we have to look at what are some of the proposals that are out there. And,
let me ask you just point blank. What are the odds of that happening if you had to just stick a percentage on it?
For this year?
Yeah. No, what do you think the odds of the 5.12 million dropping to a million? Do you think it's even 25%?
No, I don't think they're going to do that. Okay. I think most likely what's going to happen is they're going to extend the Bush tax cuts so that they can give themselves more time to come to.
So you mean maybe for a year? For 2013.
For 2013.
Okay. And then what's in President Obama's proposal?
So that gives them a little more time to be able to come up with a more comprehensive proposal, which I think is sensible. So what's in President Obama's proposal is he's going to reduce the estate tax exemption down to $3.5 million from $5 million, and then the tax rate would go up to 45%.
Okay.
And it's a little misleading. Because what happens with the calculation of the estate tax is you're actually calculating the tax first, and then there's a credit that's being given to that tax. So really, in the calculation of the estate tax, you're taxing the dollars at a higher tax rate first, and then you're protecting the dollars at the lower tax brackets. So you're actually paying more in estate tax than you really think you are, which is a little different than the income tax rate calculation. It's a different way of approaching it. President Obama would also really sanitize the estate tax laws. He would take away substantial strategic benefits, such as grantor retained annuity trusts. He would limit that to a 10-year time frame. He would eliminate the valuation discounts. So you got to think about that. If I want to sell 50% of my property to you, Rich, or 50% of a commercial building, or transfer 30% interest in a company, would you pay me full value for that particular transfer?
No, I wouldn't, because, you're not that easy to get a lot. I'm just teasing.
No,
the point is, no, I wouldn't, because Rich is really easy to get along with. The point is, I wouldn't do that, because if I want to sell it and you don't, what happens then?
Well, you don't control.
I have no control.
You have no control over it,
right.
And so nobody would want to buy that for its full value. So guys like Carl Sheeler, when he's doing valuations and appraisals on property and stock interests, he's showing us that from a true economic perspective, the value of that interest is worth less than the
100% value times the percentage.
Value.
Right. Yeah.
But what the tax law is going to do is, the tax law is going to say, well, we don't care about that. We're going to value it as if it was truly 100%.
Yeah, that doesn't correspond with reality, but that's never stopped the government before.
Never stopped the government, especially the IRS.
So here's an interesting stat about the $5.12 million exemption. The IRS predicts that for people who pass away in 2012, there will only be 3,300 estate tax returns filed where the trustee or executor actually writes a check for estate tax. There'll be many, many more estate tax returns filed, particularly situations where the first spouse of a married couple is the one to pass away because of this thing we call the unlimited marital deduction and portability, where we usually don't pay estate tax at the first death, but we do report what happened so that we can preserve and avoid estate tax with the maximum exclusion the first spouse gets. But the point is, only 3,300 taxpayers at $5.12 million, whereas if we have a $1 million exemption, the last time we had a $1 million exemption, we had 106,000 taxpayers file estate tax returns where estate tax was paid.
Well, it's a good point. And the reality, though, is that the amount of revenue that's generated out of the estate tax returns is really a drop in the bucket when you talk about a $16 trillion debt and a $1 trillion
deficit. It's nothing, but earlier in the show, we talked about policy.
Yes.
Whether it's income tax policy or economic policy, and what is the government attempting to accomplish. So what's the government attempting to accomplish with the estate tax?
Well, they're clearly just looking for a way to raise revenue, which is an easy way to do it. And by letting the Bush tax cuts expire would be an easy way to do that. I want to bring up a really important point, which is about generation skipping, because a lot of times in the strategies that we use, we want to skip over a generation and give our wealth to grandchildren rather than to our kids, mm-hmm. or maybe income to the kids, and then the actual asset over to the grandkids. And the generation skipping tax has the same kind of protections as the regular estate tax. So what's interesting about that is that under the president's proposal, doesn't matter where your trust is located, because this is federal tax law now, he would limit your trust to 90 years period, whereas a lot of people in different states may do it multi-generation.
Yeah, there's 13 states, I think, that allow you to go 100 years or even more.
I also want to make a comment that there's a decoupling that's going to occur. So the gift tax, the amount you can actually gift, even if the $3.5 million is implemented on the estate tax exemption, the gift tax law will stay at $1 million. So you can only give away $1 million in taxes. And what that means is that it costs a lot more when you die to give away the same amount of money, whereas you can do a lot more during your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the amazing thing about the $5 million, or what is now $5.12 million because of the cost of living index. It was the first time really not in history, because back when we had a $600,000 exemption and a $1 million exemption, the gift and the estate tax exemption equivalent were equal, but then the gift amount stayed at $1 million as the death tax exemption went to $1.5 million,
up and up,
and then that was a big surprise when we got that, because nobody was really thinking we would get that, and that's something the Republicans sort of demanded, and President Obama capitulated, and that's a really neat thing to have, because it's really the open the doors to do a lot of great estate planning, but not a lot of high net worth clients have. They have a deer in the headlights look, because they're saying, well, we don't have any certainty in the estate gift and trust laws, and until we have certainty, we're not going to pull the trigger and actually do planning, which I think is a mistake, because what we have now is the best we've ever had. And I don't think there's much downside to using your $5.12 million, since it's the best we've ever had, and it can't possibly get better, right?
I don't think it's going to get any better, at least in the short term. This really raises the whole question of what's legacy about. And so we get into the idea that, what if we had no estate tax at all? What would that mean for a family? What kind of planning would you do? Would you still do planning based upon taxes? Well, of course you wouldn't. But, when we talk about transferring $1 million, $3 million, $5 million of wealth, that's a lot of wealth. And so what do we do with that? How do we plan for that for people?
Here's the interesting thing for me about the estate tax. It's purely voluntary, and I think we might be taking a break pretty soon, because it's 7:49, but I don't hear any music yet. But I want to sort of say, There we go. It is. Hey, Kevin, nice job, man. But I want to talk about the income tax is not voluntary. In fact, people who think the income tax is voluntary wind up in jail. But the estate tax is voluntary. So if you want it to be your money, as in it's your money and your life, we're going to talk about that when we come back right after this break. Thanks. We're back with It's Your Money and Your Life. We don't have much time because that last segment went a little bit long. We were having so much fun talking about taxes. How much fun can you have talking about taxes? I've got to tell you an interesting stat. Rich Gaines has been a guest, I think, three times in about the last year. And Joe Becchio, it's the three shows that he's missed. So we have to find out if it's something personal or if it's just one of those statistical improbabilities. Again, Joe's visiting his mom in Chicago, so he's got a good excuse. It had nothing to do with Rich being... He didn't schedule his trip when he found out that Rich was coming on again. So, Rich, I was making the point when we went to break that the estate tax, unlike the income tax, is actually voluntary because you can do planning and you can also incorporate philanthropy, which is a fancy word for putting charities into your estate plan. You can incorporate those techniques or certain techniques that involve charities and philanthropy to actually almost determine how much estate tax you're willing to pay, even if you're worth $100 million, $200 million on up. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a great point, and we were having a conversation around being fiscally conservative in economics, and yet we can still be liberal in other areas. You and I both have daughters, and so we clearly understand a woman's right to choose in many different ways, not just the abortion issue, which, of course, is the politically sensitive one, but it's really about being liberal in terms of helping people that need help.
And creating a level playing field regardless of race, sex, belief, whatever the case may be.
That's exactly right. And so one of the ways that you can do that is, and I think this is where the Democrats and the Republicans do diverge, is that the Democrats want government to be able to do that, and the Republicans believe in the private choice. So when we start talking about charitable planning, we start looking at the opportunity of individuals to be able to give, to be able to be of service, to do the things that are good out there in the world, make a difference, and they do that by voluntarily contributing to the charities of their choice. I don't want this to sound political, but Romney made about $4,000 as he disclosed on his tax return, and he gave about $1 million of that to charity.
No, he didn't make $4,000. He made more than that.
Did I say $4,000?
I meant
$4 million.
Okay, there you go.
$4 million.
That's more accurate.
Thank you. And he contributed over $1 million of that to charity. Which benefits, of course, people, and as you said, it levels the playing field. President Obama made about $1 million, and he gave about $100,000, $200,000 of that to the charity. So you can see a major discrepancy in the amount of giving that was being done, yet somehow there was this castigation that because Romney didn't pay quite as much in the actual marginal rate, that he was a bad guy.
But Romney may also have done some gifting for estate tax reasons. I don't think President Obama would be as inclined to do estate planning because I don't think his net worth is nearly as high. I'm just guessing.
That may be true. So from an estate tax perspective, one of the things that you can do when we talk about voluntary philanthropy is you can give as much as you want to a charity, and that is a full deduction against your estate taxes, and you'll pay no tax on the amount that you give to charity.
Right, whether you do that during life or you also get an income tax deduction, it's out of your estate, or if your estate plan says, I, Richard Musio, I'm worth $50 million, which of course isn't true. When my kids asked me, how do you get rich, I said, don't have kids. But anyway, I want to give my entire estate to charity when I die. How much estate tax would I pay?
You pay zero.
I pay zero. It's totally voluntary. I don't
totally
have to pay
voluntary.
One dime because there's a thing called the charitable deduction on the estate tax return. And whatever you give to a qualified charity comes right out of the gross estate.
So some of the work that we're doing with clients right now is it's a very interesting strategy. It's called a charitable lead trust. And what that means is that we're leading by giving charity income every single year. That gives the person who's doing the donation an income tax deduction. He's getting also a gift tax deduction. So there are tremendous benefits. And the charity is also winning because they're getting income every single year. At the end of a certain time period, what happens is that the assets come back to the family. So if the financial advisor, as part of the team, does a great job of growing the money, then The charity could be, as an example, getting a 2 or 3 or 5% rate of return, where the financial advisor is generating a 6 to 8% investment growth. And so ultimately, those assets continue to grow. Now, in today's environment, the percentage rate is around 1.2% is what I remember seeing on this charitable lead trust. So that means the charity, 1.2% is the amount that you have to give to the charity.
Rich, I got to interrupt.
Yep. I hear the
music. We got to sign off. I want to thank Rich Gaines. If you want more information about that great technique, 760-931-9923. I want to thank, well, actually, two Jerrys. Thank you, Jerry Gross, for calling in. And next week, tune in because we have Mayor Jerry Sanders on, who, well, is leaving office soon. So he's going to come on the show next Sunday. It's Your Money and Your Life. Tune in next Sunday. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Attention men, every day after you turn 30, you start losing your testosterone, the hormone that makes us men. Without it, you lose muscle tone, sex drive, sleep, and energy. Now you can turn back the clock, stop testosterone loss, and safely increase your natural testosterone levels, because we're going to send you a full-size supply of Eternal Male, absolutely risk-free. Call now, 1-800-500-6363. Eternal Male is an all-natural breakthrough supplement that's proven to boost your testosterone to healthy levels so you can be the man you used to be. It will let you regain the strength, mood, endurance, sex drive, and power from your youth. You can even lower your cholesterol. Plus, clinical studies have shown that men who boost their testosterone experience amazing results losing belly fat. To get a full-size supply of Eternal Male absolutely risk-free while supplies last, call now. 1-800-500-6363. If lines are busy, keep trying. That's a 30-day risk-free trial at 1-800-500-6363.
In a different direction.
Follow the leader. 760.